Thanks for listening to Art and Family, or as I like to say in Dutch, tussen kunst en kind. My name is Myrthe Berendsen, and I'm a writer, artist, and policy advisor. In this podcast, I speak to idealists about family, for anyone questioning the status quo and wanting change, from the art world to the nuclear family, and from patriarchy to ableism, fleshing out the friction between concepts of private, personal, and public political life. In a time of doxing and political hijacking of identity and emancipation movements, this is Between Art and Family. In this conversation today, I will be joined by Lauren Elkin. Elkin is an award-winning Franco-American writer, translator, and cultural critic. In 2023, she published the bestseller Art Monsters, Unruly Bodies in Feminist Art. The book is a dazzlingly original reassessment of women's stories, bodies, and art, and how we think about them. For decades, feminist artists have confronted the problem of how to tell the truth about their experiences as bodies. Queer bodies, sick bodies, racialized bodies, pregnant bodies, female bodies. What is their language? What are the materials we need to transcribe it? Exploring the ways in which feminist artists have taken up this challenge, Art Monsters attempts to rethink the concept of monstrosity and to theorize a feminist aesthetics of the body. Thank you so much for joining me in conversation today.
Hi, Myrthe. Thank you so much for inviting me on today.
We're going to talk about your latest book, Art Monsters, about unruly bodies in feminist art. And in the book, you write that female artists are socially conditioned not to be monsters. In a discourse around the art monster, we tend to focus on the lives of artists and the excessiveness, the dirt. And in the lives of female artists, even more so. The children they abandoned, the promiscuity. But it seems just as crucial to look at their works. What was it that those female artists were doing or making that they ran the risk of being called an art monster?
As anyone who is familiar with Jenny Offel's 2014 novel Department of Speculation will recognize, I took that phrase art monster from her book, which is a book, again, if this is a podcast about family life and art and the family, then I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with it. But it's about this woman who is a wife and the mother of a very young child, and she is going through all of the torturous like things like sleep deprivation and cleaning up of vomit and feces and all of the great stuff that goes along with early parenthood. And she stops to reflect and thinks like, how did I get here? I never wanted this. This wasn't what I set out to do. I wasn't even going to get married. I was going to be an art monster. And then she goes on to say, art monsters never concern themselves with the minutiae of daily life. They're interested in their work, and that's it. And they have a helpmeet, like a wife, like Nabokov had Vera, to take care of the details. Like, you know, Gertrude Stein had Alice B. Toklas to type up her manuscript pages, and you know, Vera folded Nabokov's umbrella for him. So there's this idea that in order to be an artist, it needs a devotion to the work that really excludes the possibility of having a family or of tending to a family. And I was really interested in what that said about creative women, not just creative mothers, but women with all kinds of caring responsibilities and relationships. It seemed to suggest that because, you know, we're the ones who historically have been left behind to take care of the family while the men go out and hunt, gather, and write their masterpieces, it seemed to suggest that there wasn't a way in for us to be artists or to make art that was as important as what, you know, Nabokov was making. I wanted to write my way into this kind of conundrum. I wasn't interested in focusing uniquely on motherhood, but of course that was going to be part of it. I was really struck by a quote from Virginia Woolf's 1931 speech, Professions for Women, which was later republished as an essay by that title, where she says, looking back on her career as a writer, now Woolf didn't have children, so again, this is where this art monster idea is really relevant to, you know, all women who create. She said that the two main challenges of her life as a writer were, one, to kill off the angel in the house, and she says she did that, she died, and two, to somehow get into language the truth of her experiences as a body. And she says, I don't think I mentioned that. I doubt whether any woman has yet. So that sort of by summary, that like dual summary of the work of the artist as being both kind of professional and having to undertake certain actions in order to become a professional working artist, such as killing off the angel in the house, or, you know, refusing to care what people thought of you, or overcoming racism or prejudice or all kinds of resistance to you becoming an artist, and what it is that you're actually doing in the studio or on the page that is so important to you that you would run the risk of being silenced or sidelined or marginalized as a result of it.
Thank you for that. I was wondering, maybe we should go one step back, because what is an art monster, actually?
So, back to that Jenny Offal idea. It's someone who has a kind of massive ego and all the time in the world to create the work that he, because it's, you know, forcément, like necessarily a he, to create the work that he thinks is, it is his like God-given duty on earth to create. And so in opening up that idea to include people who might not have that kind of outsized ego or, you know, that kind of relationship to their gender, I wanted to think about maybe the idea of the art monster as being not necessarily a person where we can say this person is an art monster and that person isn't, but maybe we could think about monsters as a verb and to think that art does something in the world. It intervenes in the world somehow. It can surprise us. It can disgust us. It moves us in some way. So this idea of art monsters as the title is not just a reference to the women who have surmounted all kinds of difficulties in their work in order to make work that they found important. It's also an invitation to think about what art can do in the world.
In the book, you mention many, many artists, lots of artists that inspire you along the journey. And I think one of the most prominent artists in the book is Carolee Schneemann. And I was wondering, is she a typical art monster for you?
First of all, I think that's the first time I've actually heard a Dutch person say her last name, because of course it's a Dutch name.
I think it's German, or?
Is it really? I thought it was...
Because Schnee is like snow and in German, and in Dutch it's Sneeuw. So Schneemann is actually German.
Oh, right. Oh, I assumed it was from the double E. It was Dutch, because we have so many in New York, we have so many words with double E's in them that come to us from the Dutch. So I assumed that that was, oh, okay, so I've learned something today. Anyway, so yeah, I'm not sure if she's a typical art monster, because again, I don't necessarily want to set up a figure and then delineate who is and who isn't. But she's an interesting figure. And it kind of challenged the idea of the art monster in the sense that she didn't have children and she didn't want children. And she, you know, wrote quite a lot about that in her letters to friends, kind of defending her decision not to have them and that they would in some way make it impossible for her to make the work that she wanted to make. But as I went through the book and was sort of building connections between all of these different artists. I was linking up Carolee Schneemann to like Artemisia Gentileschi or to Maria Lasnig or to Kara Walker. And then as I, you know, drilled down, I realized there actually were like actual connections between, say, Carolee Schneemann and Kathy Acker, who were friends, or Carolee Schneemann and Maria Lasnig, who were part of a film collective together. But as I'm kind of evolving my ideas about monstrosity and art, it became clear to me that there was a kind of aesthetics of monstrosity that all of these artists were engaging in or articulating in their work that had to do with like excess, superfluity, tactility, texture, that all in some way involved the body or called into question the role of the body of the artist in the work of art. And so in a lot of cases that involved, you know, making self-portraits or working from the body out, as in the case of Maria Lasnik, who was trying to paint what it felt like to be in a body. And the case of Schneemann, I mean, she's really one of the earliest of the artists that I'm looking at in this book in some detail to say, I am both the image and the image maker. I have a body that has been conventionally the subject of art. I have a depictive body. But I'm also now making art. What are you going to do with that? So one of her pieces, I think it's called Naked Action Lecture from 1968, is a performance piece where she gives a slide lecture on art history and takes off all her clothes and then puts them back on again. And she's trying to ask the audience, you know, can I be this conventionally attractive, sexy woman and also know something about our history? It's like two very difficult ideas for the audience to hold in their mind at the same time.
I think the aesthetics of monstrosity or the role of the body within that comes very brightly to light in the work of Hanna Weelke, or I pronounce it probably very Dutch as well. Or in, as you write, like the problem with Weelke's work, the American painter and performance artist. And you even pointed out as almost a central problem of the book, where it's the problem of beauty for feminism. What is the problem with beauty?
Yeah, beauty is a problem. The problem with beauty, as I encountered it when I was researching this book, I think I get there best by juxtaposing Hanna Weelke and Eva Hesse. They're kind of contemporaneous, born around the same time, both working with idiosyncratic materials like latex. Both are sculptors by training. And then Hanna Weelke, well, Eva Hesse tragically dies of a brain tumor at a very young age in 1970, and Hanna Weelke continues living and making art. And so Hanna Weelke intersects with the feminist movement in art in a way that Eva Hesse did not, because she didn't live long enough. So I can't make these claims absolutely, because we don't know what Eva Hesse would have gone on to do. But Hanna Weelke, she was interested in the kind of gesture of making these little sculptures with one hand to see what she could do with one gesture in one hand. And they ended up looking like vulvas. And everyone said, oh God, that's the woman who makes the little ceramic vulvas. And she went with it and leaned into it and used it as a way to explore her identity as a woman and to think about the relationship between her body and the work that she was making. Eva Hesse, on the other hand, made work that sometimes was reminiscent of breasts or umbilical cords or in, you know, the female body in other ways, and said, no, that's not what I'm doing. This is not a representation of the female body or an exploration of what it is to be a woman. It's just abstract. It is what it is. And Eva Hesse is kind of lauded as, rightly, obviously, one of the great artists of the 20th century. And Hanna Weelke faced a lot of dissent from feminist art critics who were saying that she, in her work, and this is much more in her self-portraits than in her sculpture, but that she was making work that was appealing to the male gaze, that she was like a glamour girl who was trying to seduce the viewer. And Hanna Weelke was like, yes, I am trying to seduce. Why should work not be beautiful and seductive and try to do something to the viewer? Why should I not be present in the work? Why is abstraction and ugliness the ultimate values in art? And so in an interview with the art journalist Cindy Nemser, Weelke actually said those words. She said, I'm tired of going into art galleries and finding that I'm more beautiful than the work on the wall. And, you know, there's a number of reasons we might speculate as to why ugliness became a kind of value in art in the 1970s for historical reasons or just reasons of abstraction and truth of material. But nevertheless, I think that Weelke lays bare the degree to which the female body and its relationship to beauty became a problem for feminists and for the art world in general.
What's your personal stand on this? Because I was reading about Wilkie's own perception of that and dealing also with the issue of aesthetics, basically. What's your opinion on this?
I think that we have our bodies and we live in particular cultures, and our cultures tell us something about the way that those bodies should be and should look. And we either go with that or fight against it in whatever way works for us. But I think to say that Hanna Weelke's body is not an acceptable body to show in art because she accepted the kind of ideas around conventional beauty of her time. She had a nose job. She exercised. I'm guessing she was on a diet. She was going a certain distance to kind of accept the beauty standards of her time. And I don't think that that makes her body not worth looking at as a kind of tool in her art. It's not that if she had been in resistance against the beauty standards of her time, she would have been more interesting. But I think that the sort of conventional thinking around art or the kind of natural, logical next step of what those feminist artists were saying is that if she had a conventionally unattractive body, it would be interesting. But because she has a conventionally attractive body, it's currying the male gaze. So I think we have the bodies we have, and there's no use being coy about it and pretending that we're not trying to be beautiful in some way. Some of us, I'm sitting here wearing red lipstick. I have decided that this is something that I feel comfortable with, and it's how I present myself to the world, and it's embracing certain standards of beauty, and I'm okay with that. I think that the sort of main idea here is to be creating the most amount of freedom for the most amount of bodies as possible. So if Hannah Wilke were in some way excluding the right for women to not be conventionally beautiful, then that would be a problem. But I don't think that there's any indication in her work that that's what she's doing.
I think what you're saying about creating the most amount of freedom for the most amount of bodies is very essential in your writing, and maybe also the point of this book, but also as in your previous novel, For the Nose, about converting a masculine figure into a female one, is that it stands woman forever on the side of the second sex, in line with the groundbreaking work of Simone de Beauvoir. And I was wondering, isn't the work made always in reaction to or against patriarchal structures, as with the problem of the aesthetics of Hannah Wilke, for example? Do you feel like after all your work on this dichotomous thinking, basically, that there's a way beyond that, against or in reaction to the patriarchal normativity of creation?
I'm not sure that there is. I think it might be more of an ideal than an actual vein in which to practice. I think it's something that we're probably all straining towards. And as I often do in the book and in life, I come back to Virginia Woolf when I think about this question, because in A Room of One's Own, she does a kind of mini history of women's writing in English and says she loves Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte, but they weren't writing in their own language. They were writing in like a patriarchal masculine language. They were using the sentence as they had inherited it from generations of male writers. And Woolf says that what she is trying to do in her own work and what she hopes other women writers will try to do is to break the sequence and break the sentence. So that was the kind of dominant aesthetic idea that I took with me into this book in trying to think about whether it would be possible for women artists to not just make work that reacted against patriarchy, because there's lots of that and it's varying degrees of interesting. Sometimes it's not interesting at all. Just the act of rejection, for me, doesn't seem like enough in a work of art. There has to be more to it. So many of these artists, I think, through the act of going to the body and trying to think through the body on the canvas, is a way for them to attempt to sort of make work that could be ours, as in Judy Chicago's word, that isn't just a reaction against their work, but the beginning of a work of our own. I think in using techniques of breakage and reconstruction, so I use the form of the slash often in the book to break up paragraphs, because there's this, the slash is like this amazing like punctuation mark that joins together and also sets apart at the same time. Like you see a slash and it's both connection and separation. And that I find that really interesting as a kind of tool to work with. So there's this idea that if we can somehow be slashing up and breaking up and collaging and then mosaicing and putting back together and suturing and Frankensteining, as a word to use at one point, our materials, our bodies, the world around us, maybe that's the beginning of something that's not just in reaction against, but a gesture towards our own art. Not that our own art only has to do with collage, but that was what I focused on in the book.
Before I go to my next question, I was wondering if we could do a little thought experiment, because in the book you write that monsters are often conceived as like these scary creatures lying in the bushes and under beds, and how women in their unruly bodies should reclaim that space for monstrosity, as it is there where unable bodies differ from the ultimate able body, instead of the white male. But reading through your book, I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that often most monsters for women are actually men. And yes, they do wait in bushes and in our bedrooms. Most women have no need to be monsters at all, as they know the consequences of monstrosity well enough. Because monsters are also mirror a patriarchal ideal, like a repetition of moves of what it is to be good and what it is to be not good, basically. And in your book, you write a lot about the works of Virginia Woolf. And in my own book that I'm writing at the moment, I write about the fears of war and the fears of women's rights, just as Woolf writes in the 30s in Three Guineas, in which he argues that the root of fascism lies in patriarchy and that preventing war can only happen if we make small-scale changes in the story we tell each other in a form that does not yet exist. And for that, women themselves must invent new words and new methods of telling those stories. So should we, in line with her plea, stop thinking in the patriarchal terms of what already exists, like monsters, and find new words and way of seeing that?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and I'm looking forward to the book that you produce from all that thinking.
You need to learn Dutch.
Yeah, I do. Or you'll just, someone will translate it. There are some great Dutch translators. Do you know Sophie Collins, I think, translates from Dutch?
Oh, no, not yet.
First I was going to talk to you about monstrosity and etymology, but then as you ended, I was thinking about, there's a whole section, where is it, where I talk about bell hooks and Adrian Rich, who has this poem that people like to cite from 1968, where she writes, "This is the oppressor's language, yet I need it to talk to you." And then, you know, there's a kind of tradition of Black critics and artists who've taken up that idea of the problem of language, you know, like Audre Lorde's The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House, this idea that, you know, we've inherited this language or this set of aesthetics, this tradition, what are we going to do with it? Hortense Spillers is another important one in this section. Harriet Mullen. Kathy Park Hong is another person who I quote in this chapter, who has an amazing book called Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning from 2020. That is a fantastic book. I can't recommend it enough. So what Hong and Hooks and, you know, Spillers and Mullins are all thinking about is the way that language can be messed with, that we can inherit, at least in the case of the Black writers that I'm referring to, you know, there's this language of the enslaver, the master. And Hooks is saying that you can reshape that language to become a territory that limits and defines. They make it a weapon that can shame, humiliate, and colonize, but Black Americans can turn that language into a site of resistance and remake it so it would speak beyond the boundaries of conquest and domination. So what I'm doing with the term monster is maybe taking a page out of bell hooks's book and thinking we tend to use the word monster as shorthand for like bad, scary, menacing, the way you just did. You know, it's obviously incredibly important to have that word to point to kind of behaviors and crimes and atrocities that are beyond the pale and not okay. But the term monster itself has a much more rich etymological heritage and has been used at varying moments by critics and philosophers to get at something beyond just this idea of what's horrific and beyond the pale and behavior that we are not interested in. So in the OED, negative associations with the term monster come sort of late. You have earlier ones. Well, definition one is that it's a mythical creature, and then that it's something extraordinary or unnatural, an amazing event or occurrence, a prodigy, a marvel, though the editors note that that usage is now obsolete. And then in Strong's Greek, the monster is teros, a wonder, a marvel. And you have that in the Bible, Acts 2:19, "And I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and smoky vapor." And then in Latin, it comes from monstrare, to show, or from monere, to warn. So we have all of these different ideas about what the monster can be in this history of the term. It can be a sign, it can be a warning, it can be something marvelous, something wondrous, definitely out of the ordinary. And so I'm looking at Susan Stryker, who's a great kind of trans theorist who says that, you know, trans people can reclaim words like monster to draw transformative and subversive energy from it. And I'm looking at Chris Krauss in I Love Dick, who describes the monstrous as the blob. And this is really the kind of inflection of the monstrous that I work with the most in the book. She says that the blob is mindlessly swallowing and engorging, rolling down the supermarket aisle, absorbing pancake mix and jello and everyone in town, unwise and unstoppable. The horror of the blob is a horror of the fearless. To become the blob requires a certain force of will. So it's that idea of being unwise and unstoppable, fearless, you know, having this very forceful will, a determination to do what you're going to do, that I think is the key idea animating the monsters that I'm looking at here.
Thank you so much for this very eloquent, elaborate answer. I wanted to move a little bit to the direction of, let's say, multiplying motherhood. I know you've written about this also in articles, and that there's this wave of motherhood in the arts and literature nowadays about the realness, the depression, like the trauma, the terror, the sort of post-feminist awakening in the realm of motherhood. And this is something that was long missing from any form of narration or art history. And I'm all for it. This gigantic sort of mother-shaped hole in should be filled with all possible narrations. But what I do notice on a personal level, that it also feels like after becoming a mother, I also feel this enormous creative freedom and urgency in my making, as if I've grown in dimensions beyond a sort of bodily, as if part of becoming a mother is also embracing that monstrosity, where it's a sort of fearless, all-absorbing, swallowing, growling beast inside of me, almost as if my body became more political.
Oh, wow.
Which has a certain urgency with it. And in your chapter on articulation, you write about your own pregnancy while writing this book. And you said, as my body took a new shape, so did this book. I was wondering if you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I love the way you talk about motherhood just then. I have to say, this is maybe just me confessing to my own narrow-mindedness and limitations, but you say that becoming a mother made you more political or made the body more political. And I think that's true for me as well. But for me, it was more just that I was coasting through life. And I guess I thought I was politicized enough then. But it's having a child that has made me feel much more implicated in what is at stake in politics and in the world in general. And I hesitate to say that because I don't want it to sound like I think people who don't have children can't access that level of political engagement. And that's not at all what I mean. I don't want to take away from anyone else's ability to imagine or project themselves into what it would feel like to have a child. But genuinely, like for myself, I think that I was kind of sleepwalking through life until I had a baby. And it was like having a baby removed a layer of skin from my body and made me much more sensitive to what was happening in the world. I mean, I could barely read a newspaper for a couple of years because of all the horrible things that human beings do to other human beings. I mean, I couldn't deal with anything bad being done to children, but also to adults who used to be children. And it just seemed like maybe everyone in the world needs to become a parent so that you can all understand what it is to love another person. But obviously, again, that's a very dubious kind of thing to say. Well, so along the lines of this idea of when you have a baby, you are born into the institution of motherhood. When you write a book, well, especially a nonfiction book, there are templates available to you that maybe, you know, we can think of as like institutions or formalize the nuclear family. It's like a template that's set for you before you get there. And for the nonfiction book, it's like, here's an introduction. I lay out, you know, some ideas, make an argument, and then in the series of chapters that follow, you explain, argue, explore whatever the different facets of your subject. And then you have a conclusion and leave the reader with something to take on their way, and then it's done. So that was more or less what Flaneuse was. Flaneuse was a little deviant in various ways, but more or less it obeyed that kind of template. Art Monsters was meant to as well. But then I got pregnant and, you know, all hell broke loose and I could no longer write the way I was used to writing or research the way I was used to researching. I had the baby, more hell. I mean, glorious, but, you know.
Glorious hell.
Glorious hell. And then the pandemic happened and it was like, okay, now I'm stuck in my house with whatever books I happen to have to hand. And I thought of Eric Auerbach's Mimesis, which he wrote in exile during World War II, I think, and he had to write it just with the books he had in his library. And so, you know, it's a wonderful constraint, but it is a constraint. I think that the book necessarily had to take a new shape as a result of the fact that the circumstances under which I was writing it were unheard of for me and unprecedented, and I could no longer access the necessary spatio-temporal mindset that I needed in order to write a proper conventional book. So the book took this new shape not just because I was writing in the drips and drabs of time that I could carve out for myself in between, you know, mothering and childcare, but also because I just wasn't in the kind of mindset that I had been in the past for other books, or that I might be in the future. So this book, it's deeply fragmented. It works a bit like a mosaic, like there's all of these different paragraphs divided by slashes, and they don't necessarily follow on one from the next until you reach a certain point, and that kind of clinches what all the little fragments are doing. And I was thinking really deliberately about making sure that that made sense as you're reading, but it does demand a little bit that the reader kind of take these things in and sit with them without knowing necessarily what I'm trying to say yet until like maybe a couple of pages in. So it was an exploration of a new kind of writing for me. And I don't know that I would necessarily do it again. I'm working on a couple of book projects right now, but it's too early to know what the impact of having written Art Monsters and had a baby in a pandemic will be on the later work.
You mean if the fragmented aspect of your writing would be an ongoing way of writing?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still a mother.
Right.
So how is that impacting on my work now? I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Because I think it's something that like a lot of artists, makers, writers that are mothers also struggle with, is sort of how do you combine writing of being without time in your mind, even if it's an hour or if it's eight. Anyway, like how do you combine that with care duties? How do you deal with this? Also not just in your fragmented way of writing, but also on a sort of practical level. Like, do you have a very strict schedule or just practically?
Yeah. Well, I do have a strict schedule because, you know, he goes to school. So there's the time during the day when he's at school and I can work. And then we have a babysitter after school some days. And so I get a little bit of more time then, but he likes us much better than the babysitter. So he comes and finds us. And that work is not very good for concentrated, focused writing. So yeah, it's a challenge. And, you know, you just work with it.
I think that that challenge is very, let's say, omnipresent within art history, that gave us art monsters, female art monsters that left their families in order to pursue their dreams, like Doris Lessing, as she writes, like in The Golden Notebook, there's Sylvia Plath, there's Anne Sexton, there's Brammetje Cox in the Netherlands. And I wondered, is mother or parenthood really the problem? Or is it the sort of old-fashioned, romanticized idea of the artist as a genius madman, like the possessed monster, the maniac detached from conventions and mores?
Yeah, it's that, definitely.
It obviously is. It's like, I don't even know why you wrote this down.
Exactly. No, but that and the like lack of support for parents more generally, the fact that there's no universal basic income. And so women who do the labor of care around the house and for their children are uncompensated. That's just labor that they're meant to integrate into their day. And their productivity suffers as a result. It's no surprise that those women who were ferocious enough to want to make the work that they did, well, I'm talking more specifically about Doris Lessing than Anne Sexton or Sylvia Plath, who died by suicide. But, you know, for someone who actually like leaves their children and goes on and continues to live, that is a political problem. That's what was the arrangement of her life not giving her that made it impossible for her to be a writer and a mother. I mean, obviously she left, I think she was in South Africa, right? And then moved to England. So there are extenuating circumstances. But in general, I think the fact that there's very little support given to parents. And, you know, there was this article in The Cut a few months ago in New York that was really divisive. I quoted a little bit from it on Instagram. And it was basically like this woman who worked in an office, and she was complaining that the parents in her office got to leave early because they had to go home and take care of their children. And she was complaining that she and other people who didn't have children had to like pick up the slack for those other people. And it was a real like firestorm, because I obviously was like, well, ha ha ha, I'm so sorry you can't go out for dinner with your friends because you have to work. Like, I have to take care of my child. I don't remember the last time I went out for dinner with a friend. And obviously, loads of people who don't have children were like, but she shouldn't have to give up her free time to pick up the slack. And obviously, the problem is that the company that they were working for was asking too much of the people without the children, and they needed to hire more people, clearly, or don't know, like the people with children need some kind of help so they can go out for dinner from time to time, so they don't bitterly resent the people who can go out for dinner whenever they want. So it's just a very like vexed and complex problem that pits women against other women and creates false dichotomies like this, where we're actually on the same side and we're all just being exploited by the man.
I was also wondering, like, is it even important that mothers can be art monsters? Is being an art monster a goal? I'm still not sure if it's a good thing, to be honest.
It's not for me. Like, I have been asked it quite a few times, so are you an art monster? And it's like, no, I'm really not. Like, I'm pretty conventional in a lot of ways and just like to have my house be clean and take care of my kid and do my work in the interstices.
Right.
And I don't want to throw it all up in the air and go live some bohemian life in Paris and paint or something. That's fine for some people. I'm very happy to just be living my life the way I am. I just think that there are certain ways in which we could do with a bit more support from the particular country that we live in.
In your book, you write about the gains of feminism in recent decades in society, but also in the arts. But you also write about the demise in the current political climate. And what kind of artists do you think we need now or we need for the future?
That's a very good question, because I don't ask very much of artists beyond that the work be honest, you know, that it not be overly performative or pleased with itself, or that it not go far enough. I think we need artists who just have some kind of connection to something true or something, and true is not, I don't mean true in the true or false sense. I mean like in a sense of like alignment or a sense of tapping into something like sap in a tree, like that there's something kind of vivid and alive that is not hampered or overly complicated, but that also is not like overly simplistic, that isn't lying to us and telling us that things are less complicated than they are. That's a complaint that I have like in all areas of life, that I perceive the world to be an immensely complicated place. And I'm very impatient with people when they say things like, it's actually very simple. And it's like, it's not. Actually, it's much more complicated than you're allowing. And you're lying to me when you're telling me that it's simple to further your agenda. And so for an artist, I think it's a kind of delicate balance to acknowledge complexity, but also to be working in this, like, I mean, the French word is vif, something that's alive and full of sap and carries you kind of straight towards the work. Or through the work. That's all very abstract. I'm sorry. I don't even know if it makes any sense.
No, not at all. I was just, my question comes from like going through the book, and I noticed it's the artists you're writing about are predominantly writers from the past. They're a second generation feminist artists. Most of them are dead by now. So I was also wondering in terms of not per se like what artists do we need, but are there still art makers, art monsters that you admire nowadays? Or do you feel like that the discourse changed too much or so much?
No, I mean, I have Kara Walker in the book, Shutuba Biswas in the book, Jenny Saville, Rebecca Horn, although she's older. There's a fair amount of people who are still around and making work. Lorna Simpson, Claudette Johnson, who I'm going to see at the Courthold tomorrow. I mean, Ebony G. Patterson is someone who I write about at one point fairly early on in the book. And she's a prime example of what I was just talking about. She makes this work that I saw at the Tate Liverpool for their biennial, I think a couple of years ago, that is exploring the history of colonialization, of extraction, of slave labor, of movement across the Atlantic slave trade, the role of Liverpool. And her work is immensely complex and detailed. It's so much to take in when you're looking at it, that it's easy to just be like, oh God, that's so beautiful, and be done and not enter into the complexity of it and what it's asking us to do. And then in an interview, I can't remember if it was in Freeze or Artform or somewhere, she says, you know, people tell me my work is beautiful. And I'm like, is it though? When you sort of follow the logic of what it's thinking about, what is the relationship to beauty when it is inarguably beautiful? It is like striking to look at and pleasing to the eye, but about such an ugly history that, I mean, yeah, it's just that kind of relationship between aesthetics and history is one that's enduringly fascinating to me. And young artists are still, you know, very much drilling down into it and exploring it.
Do you see your writing as a form of activism in a way of making differences with your words?
Yeah, 100% I do. I am not, for various reasons, the kind of person who can go out on the weekend and join a demonstration. And I sort of, over the summer, tried to be part of a climate justice group that was doing activism and organizing and couldn't, for reasons that have to do with motherhood very much and like not having enough time, but also the demands of my work and my own neurodivergence makes it very difficult to go out and join big groups like that. And so, yeah, I think that where I feel useful and where I feel like I'm politically engaged and speaking my truth is in my work. And it was in my teaching when I taught at university, but I've had to put that aside because, yeah, it just was too much of an imposition, like the kind of neoliberalification of the British university system made too much of a demand on my time and I had to stop. But yeah, I think in terms of my translation work and what I make legible in English and in terms of my own work as a writer, I would hope that the work feels fresh or new or interesting or challenging to my readers.
Thank you. I was wondering if there's anything that you would like, well, wrapping up now, like if there's anything that you'd like to add or to ask or to say at the end of our conversation.
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty proud of this book and I hope that it finds its readers. It's coming out in paperback in April, which I'm looking forward to because it's expensive in the hardback. And I think that that makes a barrier for a lot of people who I would like to reach. So the paperback will hopefully be more accessible.
Thank you, Lauren, so much for our conversation and for your book and your courage to write this.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I'm going to say bye for now.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. It means a lot. For more episodes of this podcast and to find out more about my upcoming book on family and care, please follow us online and subscribe via the link in bio.